Hello, my name is Brian Wheeler, and I'm the executive director of Charlottesville Tomorrow. And we're a nonprofit that covers land use, transportation, community design, and public education in the city of Charlottesville and the surrounding Albemarle County. So welcome to the Virginia Festival of the Book and this program, Location Matters, Today and Tomorrow. I want to make a brief announcement here that the city of Charlottesville is helping sponsor the festival. They've loaned us city council chambers here, so we want to thank the city. They did not loan us air conditioning, it appears. So we're sorry about that and hope you dressed in layers. The event is being recorded for broadcast on Charlottesville's own TV10 and will be available online for those that want to review it in the future. If you have a question during the question and answer portion of our session, we're going to ask that you use a microphone so that we can get the questions on the audio as well. So first, let me tell you a little bit about Charlottesville Tomorrow. We're pleased to have been a media sponsor of the Virginia Festival of the Book over the past 4 years. We know the festival always brings together people that are passionate about reading and about being informed. We believe, as it says on our bumper stickers, informed citizens create better communities. That also makes a great bookmark, so you can get one of those as you leave. If you want to learn more about our work and partner with us to build a better Charlottesville Albemarle, we have a table right outside council chambers. We'd love to get you on our email list for our free newsletters that come out twice a week. Now, before I introduce our authors, a few other housekeeping items. First, please silence your mobile phones. And please consider supporting the festival. The festival is a nonprofit program of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. The festival is free of charge to you, but it's obviously not free of cost. And you can make a donation online or at the headquarters down at the Omni. You've got evaluations, the little yellow or green slips as you came in. Please turn those in after the program. And please support our authors today by buying books that they have brought with them. Catherine Laughlin has her book up here, and Rob does not have books, but he's going to give you a secret code that will let you get a discount on his book afterwards. And the format's going to be each author will talk for about 15, 20 minutes about their book, and then we'll turn it over to Q&A. And I've got a few questions just to get the ball rolling, and then I look forward to having the smartest questions come from our audience. So, today we have a pair of very interesting authors for you. Borrowing a term from Catherine's daughter, we have two city doctors. Two city doctors. One's going to tell us how we can find our place match and nurture that relationship. And the other's going to inform us about ways we can carefully plan to keep those places we live thriving with trees, parks, clean water, and clean air. Both authors are actually doctors. They have PhDs in their fields, and thus their books are backed by extensive research. First, Catherine Laughlin. Dr. Laughlin is an internationally award-winning placemaking consultant, speaker, and instructor in cities around the world. My nonprofit brought Dr. Laughlin here in 2012 to share the first findings of her research on placemaking when she was leading the Knight Foundation's Soul of the Community Project. Today, she's brought with us her book, Place Match, The City Doctor's Guide to Finding Where You Belong. Robert McDonald is a senior scientist for sustainable land use at the Nature Conservancy in Washington, D.C. He researches the impact of cities on the natural world and is the lead scientist for much of the organization's urban conservation work. His book, and I'll show it to you, is Conservation for Cities, How to Plan and Build Natural Infrastructure. So welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming. Yeah. So first we'll start with Catherine, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. I grew up, as you will be able to hear in my voice, in North Carolina. And when I was going to elementary school, I distinctly remember the ACC tournament being an excused absence if you had tickets to go. And those of us poor losers who did not have tickets to go, who actually had to go to school that day, the teacher would roll in on the TV cart, you know, the television so we could watch the games during class. And it was, so I thank y'all for coming out, because I hear there's a basketball game or something. That is loyalty. I appreciate that. But I think it was around that time when I was in elementary school in North Carolina that I realized if I wanted to have friends and be successful in this place, I needed to build my networks based on team affiliation. So I went to undergraduate at North Carolina State University. I went to graduate school at Chapel Hill. And then I taught at Duke. So that, you know, no matter who I was dealing with, I had a way to have a connection with them. But then I grew up, you know, after all that schooling, and I was annexed down to Miami, Florida for 10 years. And I learned a lot about myself down there at the time. And then I got to come back home to North Carolina. So though I am a recovering Miamian, I am a native North Carolinian. So we're back here in North Carolina, and I have a 9-year-old daughter, Grace, as Brian mentioned. And so I'm everything that goes along with that. But in my spare time, I travel the world and help places understand the importance of quality of life, not only for their residents, but for the cities themselves. And it is a really interesting body of science, I think, that we're learning about the real power of place. But I want to congratulate y'all on your choice here. I think this area is top notch. You could almost whisk me away if we can add UVA to my list of schools I can make friends by. That might work out. But the fact is that there's an increasing body of research and science that looks at really understanding the power of place. And I don't think we quite understood how important it is to us in living our best lives. Just a couple bits from the science is that, first of all, we have the first generation of young people who will choose a place over a job. Now, when you think about the way cities were designed and developed in this country, everything was focused around the place. Around the job. Mm-hmm. I mean, the job was where everything else grew out of, and that dictated everything. Well, today we have kids who will, now hold on to yourselves, show up in a place because they want to live there and, quote, figure out the job and everything else later because they just so badly want to be in that place. And so when you have those little economic development engines making those kinds of choices, then for the first time in our country's history, we have places where they could have the most wonderful jobs and great opportunities you've ever seen. If people don't want to live there, it does not matter. I mean, and that's a real change in our lives. But not only that, we're seeing in the social science literature, and we've seen this historically, but I think we've gotten even more specific about how our relationship with a place comes in and affects every single aspect of our lives. I mean, we've even seen it in the workplace, where people who feel more in love with where they live are better workers. And they're more loyal to the job, and they're more productive. So when I work with CEOs and companies, they've seen this firsthand, that if the relationship with the place isn't going well, then they have a problem with their worker sometimes. And how do we make people blur those lines between place and workplace in a successful way? But I think, really, our whole lives are about a search for belonging. More important than the research and more important than the bottom line of companies and economic development. I mean, if you think about our lives as humans, and my background is in social work, so prepare yourself on that. I take a very humanistic look at these issues. Our whole lives are a search for belonging. We look to belong in our relationships with our spouses. We look to belong in our careers. We look to belong with our friends. We look to belong in our workplaces. And we should be seeking that same kind of belonging with our places. Because just like all those other relationships, it will affect every single aspect of your life. And so if we make a good decision, we thrive. And we've seen research where people who are in connection with their environment do better around public health, they do better at the job, they do better in the family, they do better than places where people don't feel as connected to that environment. And it was really around the time that I was having shockingly wonderful success in my professional life with place and these ideas and the research, that I was also living in a place where I was no longer in love with where I lived. And my marriage had just ended, and I was in a place where I felt like I was cheerleading this love of place, and boy, it's important, and we got to feel connected to our environments, and going home at night and not having that myself. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever felt more like a hypocrite in my life. And what inspired the book for me was this moment where it occurred to me that, you know, our lives to find where we belong often are like finding that right partner to share our lives. And the marriage analogy kind of hit home for me, as I talk about in the book, live and on stage, which is really not the most ideal place to have an epiphany, but you tend to remember those quite well. So the book Place Match is really about taking you on a journey to find your heart's home and structuring it in a way where, even though I know all the science, I wanted to present it in a framework that's highly relatable. And all of us have been on a journey in relationship. And so it made a lot of sense, not only in my mind, but to make it relatable for you. So I talk about things like dating your place. And that's something we should be doing. I mean, one of the things I found in the Night Soul of the Community research is it takes about 3 to 5 years for people to fall in love with where they live. It takes about 3 to 5 years, and then their attachment kind of peaks. And then depending on how the relationship goes, and if they last that long, it might jump up and down a little bit. But it's at that 3 to 5 year mark that people seem to make the decision, this is it. This is where I want to be. And so it sort of aligns itself nicely to dating relationships, especially these days as young people wait a little bit longer to get married and date a little bit longer. You know, that 3 to 5 year mark is about the time we as humans start thinking, what are we doing here? And maybe it takes a little longer and maybe it takes a little less, but that seems to hold true. Now, there are things we should do when we're dating our place, and there's things that we shouldn't do, just like in any other kind of situation of the kind. One of the things that we should not do is decide when we're on vacation that this is the place we want to live. It is the equivalent of meeting somebody at the bar and running to Vegas next weekend and getting married. Not advisable, because I can promise you that no matter how long your vacation is, living there as a resident will be different than being on vacation there. But there are a couple of things that we should do. One of the things we should do, and I talk about this in the book, is you know, dating is about somebody puts themselves out there and you put yourself out there and y'all see how you do in interaction. I mean, that's basically what dating comes down to. And so we need to be in places that put themselves out there for us. And frankly, you know, I talk about place narratives and the identity of places. Some places can be a hard nut to crack. They don't really act like they're delighted that you're there, you know, and they don't really put themselves out there. Now, some people like a hard to get, but not everybody. That's not for everybody. So you have to make sure that, you know, can I get to know this place? And then you have to experience that place. You have to get out there and understand what this place has to offer you. And, you know, frankly, that is a really important thing to do, because historically in this country, there's something that we're doing now that has been very frowned upon, and I did it when I moved back to North Carolina, and we kind of have to unclench a little bit about this, and let me tell you what I mean. When I moved back to North Carolina after not being there for 10 years, I had to get to know my place again. I mean, it may or may not be, I mean, 10 years, 10 years here is a lifetime. Lots can change, and maybe it's the place you love, and maybe it's not. And so I did something shocking when I came back to North Carolina. I rented. And historically in this country, we've had a real certain view about who renters represent in our communities. And I'm here to tell you that I rented for 3 years and I am mostly upstanding. And this is the way that young people in particular get to know their place before they make, especially after the housing crisis of the last decade. A lot of people walked away saying, I'm good. I don't really need that whole house situation. But, you know, we do have to update our thinking around that, because a lot of kids and increasingly families are dating their place by renting. Eventually, We do want to marry our places. I mean, that is something that everybody who's vying for your attention, and let me tell you, there are mayors all over the world right now that would love for you to come live in their place and marry their place. Marrying the place is actually the goal. Because when people feel a sense of emotional attachment like you would in a marriage, when they feel that towards their place, some beautiful things happen for that place. First of all, one of the things that happens is that humans give back to that environment that they feel like they belong in. They all of a sudden no longer believe it is my future and the place's future. They see those futures together. And when you feel a vested interest in your community's future, you behave differently when you're in it. And the same thing happens for the person. When you're in an environment where you feel like you belong, in your brain, chemicals are released. You do things that you would not do in environments where you don't feel comfortable. And because of that, people make business decisions like, I think I'll start my own company here. I think I'm going to do that. I'm going to buy a house here. I am so committed to this. And then there's the little things. I think I'm going to go out and not isolate. I'm going to go out and enjoy my place. I'm going to stay here on the weekends. I'm going to spend money here. I mean, you do a series of things because you love where you live that not only helps you, but it also helps the place. Now, just like in any marriage, you're going to have bad days in your place. One fight does not mean divorce. We need to have date nights with our city where you go back out and remember, why is it that I love it? Because the goal in our relationship with place, just like our goal with relationship with someone, is that it's resilient. It's not that it's perfect. It's not that every day is wonderful. It's that you can bounce back together no matter what life throws your way. And then, of course, sometimes you can't bounce back. And this thing called divorcing your place does happen. And I can remember when I was down in Miami, a few things happened to me when I became newly single and in Miami that told me that though Miami might have served my needs at one point, it had changed. It was no longer going to be the place for me. And it was really around the time that my daughter was about 3 or 4 years old. And, of course, I grew up in North Carolina. And that means, one of the things that means is when you see people, you say hi. You acknowledge people, right? And so I'm teaching my daughter manners, you know, in Miami. And we are getting on an elevator. And, of course, we lived in a high-rise. So we're getting on an elevator. And I'd just been talking to her about, you know, how important it is to speak to folks. And this man got on the elevator. And she said, hello. And he turned his back on her and just faced the elevator doors. Have you ever been trying to teach your child a value and they go practice that value in the world and it explodes in their little faces? That's the look my daughter gave me in that elevator. And I do one of these, right? Like, I'm not sure. And she looks down and kind of collects herself and then walks up next to the guy and she goes, hola? Assuming there must be a language barrier here that's stopping this interaction from going the way I want it to go. And, you know, he still didn't acknowledge her. And I think I was just like, okay, because the place was working against my parenting. I couldn't let her out in the world of that place. And then every day it was like a deprogramming I had to go through. And I said, this is it. I've got to go back home. And I want her to be raised the way I was raised. And her father agreed. And Miami was just too hard for me to raise her there. And so I had to come back to North Carolina, and city doctor or not, I had to go through everything y'all go through to be on this journey to find where we belong. It is truly a journey that none of us are immune from. And, you know, I'm not absolved from the stress of it. I'm not absolved from the good or the bad of it. I had to learn how to hang my own Christmas lights and catch my own snakes out of the bird nest in the backyard and do my own taxes and be in a neighborhood where I was the only divorced woman for at least as far as my eye could see. And I was very insecure. You know, will I be welcomed? Will they think divorce is contagious in Cary, North Carolina? You know, will I make it fine? And I did. And you will too. So in conclusion, I just want to say what I usually say when I sign the books, which is I encourage your journey. And I want you to become more thoughtful about it. This isn't rocket science, but I want to take it from back here to up here. That's my job. And so think about your relationship with place and all the ways it does affect your life. And my hope for you is that you all find the place match you seek and the belonging that you deserve. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. All right, Rob.
Yeah. Can you hand me the book, Brian?
Yep.
I was not coordinated enough with my publisher, Island Press, to have a big stack of books, so I'm feeling definitely author envy for Catherine here. So my book is called Conservation for Cities, and it's with Island Press. And there is a, if anyone wants to come up afterwards, there's a 20% discount code I can give you to get it from their website. I am also from North Carolina, which was kind of a weird serendipity of this panel. I'm from Chapel Hill as well. And I will say I was also very envious of that beautiful pedestrian mall you guys have out there in Charlottesville. There's nothing like that in Chapel Hill, and you guys should be proud of that. My book and my work really with the Nature Conservancy is about the nature piece of that. So part of what's beautiful about that space, and just part of it, is those beautiful trees, right, that's lining that pedestrian walkway. And so ecologists like myself, that's my training, are asked more and more to understand, well, what is the value, maybe even in economic terms, but certainly in social place-building terms, to having those beautiful street trees, right? And so I want to zoom out a little bit from Catherine's talk and talk about why placemaking and the role of nature in cities is so important. It's because we're in the middle of the biggest mass migration in history, and it's this movement of people to cities. And it's sort of easy to lose track of that, especially in the U.S., where we've been pretty urbanized for 30, 40, 50 years now. There will be around 3 billion more folks in cities by 2050. So to get your head around how fast the pace of growth that is, I live in Washington, D.C. now, so forgive me for that. Picture all of D.C., right? All the roads, all the bridges, all the buildings. Picture building that in about 2 weeks and then doing that again and again and again. That's the pace of urban growth globally. It's just scattered around. So we're making tens of thousands of new places that will be where most of us are going to live. And so for the conservation community, it's this big moment of truth, right? 80% of people will be living in this new urban area. Will they care about nature? And how should we as a conservation movement respond to that? And I think there's two minds. Okay, one of them is maybe best exemplified by a phrase that Bill McKibben used 30 years ago now. Bill McKibben wrote about sort of the end of nature, okay? And what he meant by that was we're in this world where humans are controlling or affecting everything, whether it's with climate change, with this massive urban growth. There's nothing truly natural, meaning untouched by people, left. And so if you believe in that point of view, and a lot of environmentalists do, then cities are the death of nature, right? They're totally created spaces. And I think there's some truth to that, right? I work for an organization, the Nature Conservancy, that first and foremost is about protecting biodiversity. One in four of the threatened species in the U.S. are threatened because of urban growth, right? And so you have to respond. You have to think about how do you plan for all that urban growth. You do have to think about cities as a threat. And I talk in the book about smart ways cities plan for their growth so they protect some of that biodiversity. But I also want to talk to you as someone who lives in a city, right? Picture the LA River. That's kind of the poster child for the worst river in the U.S., right? Totally channelized, big concrete channel carrying stormwater down to the sea. That's bad for the fish and the birds, but it's also bad for the people who live in that city. And so if 3 billion more folks in cities and a new urbanized area of about the size of the state of Texas, that's what we're talking about globally doing, if it's a world of a lot more LA rivers, that's a really depressing future to most environmentalists. And so what motivated me to write the book is to talk about how do you put nature into cities and why should cities try to seize upon the power of nature to improve their life. And it's really a practitioner's guide, an activist guide, and I walk through different ways, different challenges cities are trying to reach with nature. So I talk about protecting their drinking water supply. How have cities tried to maintain forests, work with farmers so their water is clean? And how do they keep doing that with climate change affecting their water supply? And it was fun to have lunch with Brian because he talked about Charlottesville's journey there, right? To think about, as you need more water supply, how do you get that? I talk in the book about stormwater, which is a huge issue for many cities. There's more than 700 cities in the U.S. where still, when it rains hard, raw sewage gets dumped into streams. It's gross. It's also illegal under the Clean Water Act. And so there's more than 700 cities under consent decrees from the EPA to reduce that stormwater pollution. All of them are looking at a mix of, I'm going to use some jargon here, sort of gray and green infrastructure solutions. So the gray infrastructure solution there is widening the stormwater pipes, shunting the water around downtown. My own city, D.C., is spending close to $3 billion to build a big pipe. But the green infrastructure side is, in the case of stormwater, little constructed bits of wetlands that are supposed to slow stormwater down, encourage it to infiltrate down. And so it's also exciting that in the nation's capital, there's now this effort to recreate parts of nature, parts of nature services, to deal with this pressing problem, both to help the city and also to keep the Chesapeake Bay clean. And that was neat, also having lunch with Brian and realizing that, you know, we're still in the same Chesapeake Bay watersheds, and actually the rules, the EPA rules that affect DC are affecting here as well. And then moving into the center of the city, I talk about the value of having a street tree for cooling down the street. More and more cities are doing what are called heat action plans, so thinking about how heat waves will affect them in the future. And so the Nature Conservancy, for example, is involved with the mayor's office in New York, and they're asking us questions like, how many street trees would we have to plant to cool the air by 1 degree Fahrenheit? Where would you do that to protect sensitive populations, which in the case of big heat events, it's mostly the elderly and people who often don't have a community around to support them in those big heat waves events. So it's a part, it's not the biggest part of that heat action planning, right? Because you still need cooling centers, places where they see, you need the medical community ready to get the elderly to those cooling centers. But it's exciting that there's dozens of cities thinking about tree planting as part of that solution, and there's science tools to help you plan where they can go. I talk about air quality in trees. Kind of a related issue. People don't realize that a row of street trees separating you from a highway can reduce particulate matter by 20 to 50%. And that has real clinical health benefits. I was driving here down Interstate 95 and passed an apartment building in the suburbs of DC that had the preschool playground facing Interstate 95 with just a little chain link fence separating them. And that's the kind of situation where there's a lot of research now saying you would want a row of trees there, both so the kids are seeing trees and also so they're not getting the particulate matter, this fine particle dust from the road. And then I guess getting into some more intangible stuff, I talk about the role nature plays in our physical and mental health. So physical health, a lot of it is just getting people out and exercise. So having parks has been shown to be really crucial to that, and having cities where you can walk has been shown to relate to body mass index, for example. You can predict how healthy cities are by how much people walk. The mental health benefits are probably the newest piece of that, but to me, some of the most exciting. So there was a study in Barcelona recently that school kids are learning better on average when they have trees nearby. And there's a study just coming out in California that's showing something similar. There was a study a few years ago that looked at the rate of healing of folks in hospital. They were recovering from gallbladder surgery, and they were assigned randomly to rooms that had a nature view or that didn't. So this is just nature through a window. And people healed about a day faster on average when they had that nature view. So then related, going back to place matching, you see cities, I sit in a lot of meetings with cities, and they want to place make. They want to have their city be attractive to young folks, to high-tech industries, and so they're thinking about what is the role of nature in all that, in having an attractive, livable, walkable city. So the book is almost a I love that they have sort of a website aesthetic, because it's almost like you're interested in this power of nature, this specific aspect of nature. Here's how you plan for it, and here's how you would start using it in a city council meeting or an urban planning talk. So that's really the nuts and bolts of the book. I'll just say a couple things in closing. In the book, I maybe get a little wonky, and I use this lingo around ecosystem services, which is the benefits nature provides to people. That's a really utilitarian way to talk about it, right? And the book does get into how would you quantify the dollar value of street trees to property, the residential property values. There's a way to do that, actually, and it's quite significant. Trees in front of your house increase your property value usually by $3,000 to $5,000 in the U.S. It's pretty normal, one tree. But it doesn't have to just be a dry utilitarian calculation. What I'm writing about in the book is the common good and the role nature plays in our common good and our common wealth. And if you think about it that way, it's part and parcel of what urban planners have been trying to do for a while. It's just now we have new tools that help us use nature in a smarter way, in a way that maybe Olmsted would be jealous of. You think about Frederick Law Olmsted, he talked about parks as a respite from the hustle and bustle of nature, right? It's just now we can quantify in real mental health terms, for example, the value of Central Park to people in New York. The second thing I'll say in closing is just to reflect back on this idea of the end of nature, right? Is the urban world the end of nature? And I'm arguing in the book that it doesn't have to be. At least it may be the end of nature with a capital N, right? Truly untouched nature is really rare and it's special, and my organization works to protect those sort of remote parts of the world that are still wild. But it turns out that at the moment that we're becoming a truly urban species, right, Homo urbanus, we also need nature. And we are going to get the world we choose, and we're going to get the world we deserve. So it's our choice about how green that urban future is. And I truly believe we have a more green path out there that would make us all happier. But we have to start fighting to create that world. Because if we don't fight to create it, we'll end up with a world of a lot more LA rivers. And that's what motivated me to write Conservation for Cities and motivates me to come around and talk to folks like y'all.
Thank you. I think I'd like to start asking each of you one question, and then I have a question both of you might address, and then we'll take audience questions with the microphone out there. You know what, Catherine, when I first got your book, Place Match, and I started thinking about myself, of course, right? And
yeah.
And I've been having a relationship with Charlottesville for quite a while, 30-plus years.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get divorced from Charlottesville. I don't want to go somewhere else. I love mm-hmm. this place.
Mm-hmm.
So why would I need to read this book? And then I read the
Thanks,
book.
Thanks, Brian. That's super.
I know, but there's a second part of this.
Oh, good.
Okay, good. And then as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh, my God, this could be so much better. The community.
Oh, good.
I'm thinking if we practice some of the things in here you're talking about.
Right.
Charlottesville could be even better
right.
as a place. So I'm telling that to the audience of people who may love Charlottesville, that there's a lot we can learn, even if you feel like you've already matched. So for the people out there who feel like they have a match in Charlottesville, what would you tell them? Give some more specific examples of things you can do when you hit a bump in the road or you're getting maybe complacent in your relationship.
Well, and I think, you know, if I was talking to a room full of city leaders who would normally sit up here, I would say something around the lines of, you have to always optimize who you are, but be who you are while being the best who you are that you can be. Don't sell out. There is nothing wrong with small town. There's nothing wrong with medium-sized town. There's nothing wrong with big cities. But what people end up doing is that they get a good thing and then they lose their minds. I don't know how else to explain it, where they sort of forget who being who they are is what brought y'all all in love with them in the first place. And then that one thing or that combination of things that make people love where they live, it gets changed because they think it's necessary for some reason. So with city leaders, I have one talk, but with, you know, folks like us, I say there are going to be times in your place where you're not going to love every decision that's made. You're not going to be happy with every direction. There's going to be things that show up in the paper that make you question your choice. And what I talk about in the book is how you maintain that relationship over time and things you can specifically do to hold on to that place match. And one of those ideas is really, you know, having date nights with their place. I ran the Jane's Walk program, of course, in Raleigh, North Carolina, and all that is a bunch of citizen-led walks around different parts. You know, no training, no sign-up. I mean, scary stuff. No infrastructure. People signed up to lead walks, and people signed up to go on those walks, and they learned something new about their place, or maybe something they've forgotten about their place. I mean, that's a great example of having a date with your city, and it's really, really important. But I think the resilience idea is also critical, that you will not have a perfect relationship with your place, even if it is the place for you. Your goal with your place should be that resilience idea, that things happen and y'all are in it together and you come back, you know, and you come back to where you belong with each other. And places need to be resilient, but our relationships with them have to be resilient as well, not perfect, and there's a real difference there.
Thank you. All right. So, Robert, your research is helping us evaluate cost benefits in some cases of things we can do to be more resilient and livable in our city. Human nature, however, seems to be focused on fears and frustrations right in front of us. So crime, traffic, taxes, our jobs, pocketbooks, et cetera. How can we get people thinking longer term about their personal health and the health of their city, besides buying your book and reading?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And let me give you an example of where that came up and also where I think as a city they tried to deal with it. So got a chance to go up and spend some time with the folks at the Plant a Million Trees campaign in New York City. So Bloomberg was funding this huge effort to plant a million trees, and at the beginning, they hit a lot of resistance from many communities in New York. And the resistance was actually fear of what those trees meant. Okay, so they were worried, a lot of fears of branches breaking off trees and like falling on their cars. And there was someone in Central Park who got hit by a branch. And then there was a lot of legitimate fears potentially of, well, what does this mean for street crime, right? And so a lot of resistance. And they started talking with the community about, well, what are you worried about in terms of your environment and the health around you? And people were really worried about air quality and how hot it was in the summer. And so the city shifted gears entirely, and because they started off planting in the public right away, so public parks broadly. And they shifted gears and started prioritizing streets that had no street trees. So it was an equity issue, and they framed it as an equity issue. We are going to help some of the poorest neighborhoods in New York City get more street trees. We're going to do this because we're going to make it less hot in the summer, and we want to help you have some healthier air. And they got communities to buy in and actually now be stewards and help maintain those trees. So it was a reframing task. And so I want to sort of validate what you said. People like me get called in to talk about the costs and benefits of, you know, it's going to cost X amount of money to plant a million trees. It turns out it's a lot of money because it's, you know, $50 or $100 a tree. And then what's the benefits in terms of air quality and human health and temperature? And we can do that in the environmental community. But there was as much a battle for the hearts and minds of those citizens that the city had to do. And that was communicating with them about their concerns in a really human way. And that was super important.
So sort of playing off of that, and maybe we'll start with Robert, a question for both of you. What role can citizens play in keeping a city great? And should it be our elected officials or the planning staff that are doing all this work? A lot of people, you know, sort of think we can defer to them. They will take care of us on this front. But I think both of you have, you know, examples of the role individual citizens can play. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I'll just say that I think it can be either or both, ideally. And there are great examples in the book of specific projects that started out with just a citizen who had an idea. You know, so the New York example is a bit more top down. That's you know, vision from City Hall, but that study, for example, of hospitals and do people heal faster when they have a view of nature, and that was just one doctor who said, you know, I think this might be important. And basically everyone else in the hospital made fun of him, and the scientific community in the U.S. really laughed at him. And but that one person, so I'm going to follow through on this, showed this effect, and now there are hospitals all over the world that are planning, particularly new hospitals, planning their facilities so that they have a view out on nature, right? So one person can really definitely change how things play out.
Catherine, what do you think?
Well, Mitchell Silver, who is the New York City Parks Commissioner, also used to be the planner for the city of Raleigh. He's a friend of mine and wrote the foreword of the book. And it really, he's not exactly the reason why, but people in Mitchell's position who run cities in a very specific aspect of quality of life is the whole reason for the section of the book called Mayors as Mothers-in-Law. And because I feel like on the leadership side, because I've worked with very many of them, you know, we all know what a good mother-in-law does for us. She's facilitative of the relationship between the people, you know. She helps to make sure that that relationship is going well. And, of course, a bad one is sort of always in the way, and I know what I'm doing, and, you know, I got this. It's a different way to think about servant leadership in your cities. But when we did the Night Soul of the Community project, we found every place that we studied. So we've studied 26 places over 3 years, 43,000 people. The same things about a place is what you have to fall in love with if you're going to be there. And they're the same everywhere in places like Detroit to Macon to Charlotte to Miami. The same thing showed up, and it was how much you like the social offerings of a city, how much you like the aesthetics of a city, and how welcome, how comfortable in your own skin do you feel in that place. And so in the book I talk about, you know, a lot of those things are up to us. It's not up to the leaders to provide that to you. It's what do you contribute to the availability and how you deal with each other civically and civilly within social offerings, because it's not just about having a lot of fun stuff, things to do. If you go there and you're miserable because of how people treat each other, you won't go back. So you might as well not even have it. So that civil discourse in a community, how welcomed you feel, doesn't have as much to do about what these guys say and do, but what we do to each other in the cities. And so it really is up to us to create the narrative and the identity of our places. And of course, our leadership is a facilitator in that final stop. But we all have a role to play in the creating the cities that we want to be, and then people can be naturally attracted to that or maybe somewhere else. And that's what Place Matches is really all about, how we contribute to our own environments, but we need to find that environment where we feel that connection, because it does all feed off each other in that systemic way.
Great. All right. Do audience members have questions? And if you do, raise your hand and a microphone will magically appear.
About 30 years ago, I lived in Vermont, and a big topic there was the decline, the decline of open land, mm-hmm. and the great increase in forested land. And they would cite figures like about 1880, from 1880 to 1980, it went from about 80% open land to 80% forested land. And they were particularly concerned because tourism, they say, rests very heavily on the idea of contrast between open land, seeing a beautiful dairy farm and a red barn, and maybe some forest behind it. So that was one thing I noticed. Another is, and more recently, people have say, my God, the deer are everywhere. We have possums and squirrels and skunks and everything in our yard. It's because we've destroyed the habitat, natural habitat. And then a man, I think the name, like Sturba, Jan Sturba, wrote a book, reviewed in New York Review of Books, in which he said, false. We've created beautiful habitats for deer. He said, what animals worry about is predation and food. And there's very little predation in your backyard, and there's plenty of food. We plant flowers, and we all have experiences. They eat up. I just moved some tulip beds up thing up on my porch. They just eat them off every year. So that was another thing that we maybe don't understand. And then your point, Robert, about going, 3 billion people are going to go to big cities. And I thought, wow, that makes a great opportunity for forests to grow and overtake land. And so it's not all, there's something very, very good about that. So those are just some ideas. Comment, please.
Any reactions?
Yeah, I'll go first. I used to live briefly in Massachusetts, so I know that whole story of, for those of you who don't know it, New England and actually a lot of the East was mostly cleared for farmland and now is reforesting. And you're right, there's concerns about the beauty of the landscape and also in some places the wildlife. So there are certain species that really depend on open fields and there's less of them. From another perspective, though, New England's going back to what it was, right, which is mostly forest, and there's positives about that. What I write about in the book is how you are optimizing landscapes for certain things. You're making choices about what they are, and there are trade-offs, right? You can have a forest growing in New England, sequestering a lot of carbon. That's actually great for climate change. So the U.S., when they're in the negotiations around climate change, is takes credit for that. But there's these trade-offs that maybe it's not as beautiful. And so as a society, through individuals acting, through governments, we have to decide what our landscapes are going to look like. One of my themes in the book is this idea of having a love for your landscape. And I quote this idea of René Dubois about wooing the earth. And I like this phrase, right? Because it's not just utilitarian. We're deciding the place we want to fall in love in, mm-hmm. to use Catherine's term. Mm-hmm. So that's the challenge. I'm coming at it from this technocratic dimension to talk about what are the advantages and disadvantages of making our landscape be different ways. But we're also deciding where we want to live and what kind of place. And that includes, you know, is it deer habitat or not? You're totally right that deer like open habitat. So we've really made a great habitat for them. And it going to your final point about opportunity, yes, that this big urbanization is an opportunity for some of the more rural parts of the world to rewild. That's especially true in the U.S. and in Europe. Wild sort of in quotes, right? We're not talking about dinosaurs or mastodons roaming around. But there will be places on the earth that are going to be more forested, more natural habitat than currently. It's actually a limited part of the world, though. In a lot of the developing world, there's just so much momentum for population growth that while there's this huge movement in China, for example, from rural areas to cities, you are not going to see the Chinese landscape rewild. That's still going to be mostly rice production.
I think what my take on what you said is first of all the importance of narrative of places, that all places have an identity, that we have to know what our narrative is. You know, one of the dangers after the Seoul Project came and got all of this press attention was that people would just start doing social offerings, aesthetics, and openness in their city without being very mindful of the context of that city in developing that. We knew just enough to be dangerous, and I saw a lot of cities that were just, oh, that worked there, let's try that here. And sometimes when you do that, you sell out, like I said before, the thing that made you unique, that gave you that competitive advantage that you want to take advantage of. And so when you talk about tourism, I work with a lot of tourism boards, and I say your number one customer for tourism is your residents. Because if your residents don't buy it, you've already started sliding down the path of no return, because it has to feel authentic to that place. And you might be giving away the thing that gives you that economic advantage, why somebody would want to be here in your place versus someone somewhere else. And, you know, we studied natural spaces as part of the aesthetics that we looked at in places. And it is how you preserve and maintain the green spaces and what you build. You know, when you get there, that is the aesthetics. It's natural and created. And we have to realize that, you know, aesthetics looks very different in different places, obviously. There is a New England approach to aesthetics that's different than the Miami approach to aesthetics. And part of our journey, what I talk about in Place Match is, you know, if you looked at a picture of a forest and wildlife and mountains and that kind of view versus a very crowded beach in Miami, those are both aesthetics. And some people love one picture way more than the other. And sometimes with groups, we go through and show like the extremes of each. And you will intrinsically be more attracted to one than the other. That is how places can just keep being who they are, but be the best who they are, and how people can figure out what they're naturally attracted to, so that we end up with people who are well matched together, both not only as residents, but also as the people we attract through tourism.
Great.
I've lived in I guess I have a place match in Charlottesville. I moved here in 1971, and I'm still here, and I love it. You can hardly imagine, though, the changes that I've seen in 45 years. and when I first moved here and had been here for a few years, it felt like everywhere I went, I encountered people that I knew. Mm. And now it's becoming... I still sometimes encounter people that I know, mm-hmm. but I can often go to some event and not know a soul.
Right.
that's sort of a preface. But my question is there an optimal size for a city in terms of having a sense of belonging and feeling welcome and feeling connected to it?
Well, the short answer is no. Part of what you buy in the narrative of the place is the size that it offers you. And so if you think about how welcomeness and openness and networks work in New York City, it's a much different ballgame than in Raleigh, North Carolina, or in Charlottesville. Some people like that idea that I'm a part of a community, but we're not stopping in the grocery store and talking for 20 minutes, that kind of community. Some people are really looking for that kind of place where, you know, I can be a part of a community, but not need to talk about it all the time, that we're all together and all that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some people really like that New York City feel. And other people like the idea of, you know, if you've stopped over the corn on the cob stand in the grocery store, somebody's going to come. I know it happened to me in Raleigh the other day. This lady came up to me. She goes, you know the best way to make corn on the cob? And I'm like, God love you for being here, because if you were in New York City, it would not go well. But I'm here for this reason. You know, this is what I love about it here. And I sat there and listened, and she told me about microwaves and ice cubes, leave the shuck on, salt, blah, 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 the whole thing. And that's the thing. You know, I think that cities get nervous about growth, and I understand that, because it can happen at the expense of preparation and infrastructure. But by the same token, I think that cities like ours do pretty good, because you can be on your own and independent in your city and then maybe sometimes see somebody you know, as long as that mix feels right to you and it's not giving up what the city should be, you know, that Charlottesville's not trying to be New York City or vice versa. It's about feeling an attachment to that city as it is, I think, really. And so there is no magic number, although cities have to be increasingly aware of their infrastructure. As they are able to attract more people there, it can start to change things. And frankly, when we have what I call long-term tenured residents, people who have been here as long as you have, when their attachment starts to tank, they say two things to me. This stopped being the place for me a long time ago, and I just didn't have the economic means to leave. Mm-hmm. And that's called stuck in place, and it's a difficult thing to watch a resident go through. Or they say, this place just isn't what it used to be, and I cannot find that connection that I had before. So kudos to you, frankly, for being able to notice that there are some changes in it and, you know, see some things that are different but still making peace with it. That's that resiliency structure that I keep talking about.
Rob, what about that tension with population growth and this move to cities? The conversation in Charlottesville is some of the density and taller buildings the community is seeing, it's not always happy with, yeah. And it brings traffic and more people. And
right.
How do you deal with that?
It's a huge topic of conversation in so many cities now, and I don't think there's an easy solution except that you have to know that it's almost always impossible to stop urban growth, right? So a city, a particular place, can decide to slow it down, prevent taller buildings, but you need to realize that you're making a decision that that development will go somewhere else, right? That might go for that to the suburbs, it might go to another city. Some communities are okay with that, right? But that's a choice communities have to make.
Right.
A couple thoughts going back to your comment. I present this narrative of this huge urban growth, and so people think about the New York cities, but actually the majority of that big urban growth is in smaller cities. There's this increase in population in cities all over the spectrum, from smaller communities to mid-sized cities to these big cities. And if anything, the economic growth is most robust in that middle city size. Mm-hmm. And there are some costs to companies of being in very big metro areas, that it just, the congestion gets high, the rent gets high. And so middle-sized cities seem to be at a real competitive advantage right now. The other thing I'll say about connection is there's been some interesting studies about this. People's perception of community relates to where they live. So if growing up in Chapel Hill, if you ask people in Chapel Hill what their community was, they'd probably just say all of Chapel Hill. Living in D.C. now, if you ask people in my neighborhood their community, they would say, oh, Tenleytown, which is the nearest metro. And so people actually tend to define their community at about the same number of people. They just sort of shrink it. So then you get into Manhattan, and your neighborhood is like one block. And there's been some interesting research. It's not true that in bigger cities you interact with people less. In fact, because you tend to walk more in big cities and there's more kind of chance interactions than in other parts of U.S. society where we're pretty car dependent, interactions with neighbors tend to go up in many cities. So I don't think it's a one-to-one trade-off, like big cities have less interaction, but it does change, right? And if I leave my little neighborhood of Tenleytown in D.C. and go two subway stops over, I will never run into anyone I know. And that is sometimes like a scary prospect, right? Whereas when I grew up in Chapel Hill, I could go anywhere in Chapel Hill and run into the same people, which was both exciting and sometimes claustrophobic.
I have a question. I think it's along the lines of what you were just saying, and depending on your answer, perhaps a follow-up question. So I was impressed by this statistic you quoted about growth, right? And I'm wondering if you could comment or project about the growth rate for a place our size. I don't know if you call Charlottesville a city or even not.
Yes.
Or mid, you use some terminology. I'm not sure where we rank in this size spectrum. And we've lived here for about 10 years, frankly, expecting to see more growth than I think we have. So I was curious if you could project what we might expect here.
So how big is the Charlottesville
area? So the city is about, let's say, 45,000 people. The surrounding county adds 100,000. So 145.
Yeah, so absolutely, that's a city. I mean, people usually start, in the global numbers, start talking about cities as anything above 50,000, and then you have towns anything above 10,000. So that's in the small to medium city size. In terms of the global numbers and even the U.S. average numbers are meaningless when you talk about a certain city, though, right? So there are, and I could, if you want to talk afterwards, I can refer you to them. There are specific projections that the EPA put together for certain cities, and it's actually an interesting guess to see how well is my city going to grow compared with other cities. But the overall average for the U.S. is meaningless in the sense that each city is its own economy and is its own place. Mm-hmm. So Charlottesville, you know, you're blessed with this major university and it being in a certain location, and that is going to shape your growth forecast in a really different way than a city of the exact same size that doesn't have those amenities. So in a sense, if you're going to plan for growth, that generic average isn't too helpful. You know, you have to think about what's happening with the economy in that specific place.
So there's some resource we could look up that might list Charlottesville.
Yes, and I can show you that. I mean, they tried to estimate it for every city in the U.S., what they think in 2030 and 2050 it would be. And I'm sure, actually, local governments usually do that growth planning, yeah, too, so there's probably more accurate local
The best numbers. Local government data is related to the community water supply plan. When that was studied over the past decade, there was a lot of effort put into the population growth projections. I'd be happy to share those with you.
But what's the ballpark? Do you know?
It depends. You know, it was in 10-year intervals, yeah, and I don't remember the specifics. But
so the follow-up question actually is about water. That's something that concerns me a lot. Mm. About a month ago, I was in India, and I found it interesting that the bottled water had visibly floating things in it. Mm. Okay. So part of my question I'm curious if you could address is how much of our daily lives is spent using absolutely clean drinking water for things that I would presume wouldn't really need to be that clean. And if drinking water really becomes such a limited resource, if there are thoughts, developments for infrastructure planning that would use other sources of not entirely clean water for those, you know, things like watering your lawn or flushing a toilet or something like that, so that we can still have a reliable source of really clean water for our health.
Yeah, so drinking water supplies are something I work on a lot, and you're right to be concerned. We're moving into this space globally where there'll be a lot more demand for drinking water, and with climate change in some places, the supply will be less certain. So some research I've worked on talks about a few hundred million people in cities that will probably be water stressed. So water stress means that not that there isn't water in the tap. Usually cities find a solution to supply water to their residents, but that supply will be tight, that there may be conflict with other sectors, or that the treatment costs will go up. So the truth is we live in a world where technologically, if you have enough money and enough energy, you can take almost any water, no matter how dirty it is, and make it potable. But as watersheds get degraded and you have to go to other sources like desalination or groundwater and you have to treat it more, it gets more and more expensive, or you're building a pipeline to grab it from somewhere further away. So that's really the dimension, is as our landscape gets degraded and our cities demand more water, how much are we going to pay for water and how far do we have to go to get it? I'm confident most cities will get it, with the possible exception of some places in the third world where they just don't have the money to set up that infrastructure. So you asked specifically about the difference between, you know, potable water and then water for other use, which is sometimes called gray water. And yeah, a lot of cities are thinking about separating those as one means to make smarter use of the supply they have. And there's other ways, right? In a lot of cities, 10 to 30% of the water is basically lost due to leaky pipes. So fixing leaky drinking water pipes is another strategy cities are using. And then the biggest user of water in most US cities is for irrigation, right? It's lawns. And so a lot of cities are thinking through, how do we price our water or have other incentives so that people aren't, especially in arid areas, this is more of an issue in the Western U.S. now, aren't trying to do lawns in Phoenix. So that combination of factors could reduce urban water use often by 50% or more in most cities. And it's going to be that plus, you know, working on the supply side that cities will have to do over the next 30 years. But it's a huge challenge for a lot of cities.
It'd probably take one or two more questions.
Can I just say something real quick, Brian,
yeah,
about
sure.
that? You know, I deal a lot with the perceptions that people have with their place. And when we were looking at this issue of how attached people are to their place and why does it matter? You know, Soul of the Community was about what makes people love where they live and why does it matter? And it's all based on perception, except for these administrative outcomes that we compared it to. So people in places that had high levels of people feeling attached to it, which was this multidimensional construct of different things, did better economically. They had higher levels of economic growth. The other thing that we looked at was school dropout. You know, so the higher levels people are attached to their place, the lower the school dropout. public health. It seemed to matter for that. And then we got to population growth, population change in places, and it wasn't significant. And we were a bit stumped by that, because if everybody loves where they live and that's higher in your place, you know, what's happening where it's not necessarily growing at a empirically statistical significant rate? And I sat around 26 places across this country over 3 years and talked to people about it. And they said, oh, we're not going to tell anybody about this. You know, part of the strategy in places was like, no, we're not, you know, screaming this from the rooftops. And when I went back and looked at the data, you could see that one of the things we asked people about is, would you recommend this place to others? And people who were very high in their attachment would not recommend it to others at all, you know? And so when I sat this, the difference between reading data and sitting down and talking to people, because then you understand, you know, the nuances of the strategy. She's, you know, they're stupid, but not so stupid, because they have figured out that one of the strategies there was like, well, we kind of worried about some of these issues, and so we want to keep it.
So we should not have brought you here. Is that what you're saying? Don't tell our secrets.
That's right. No, I shan't. I shan't tell.
I'm fascinated with your analogy about the dating, and in the category of romance versus reality, I wonder what the and it may be in the book, the questions I should be asking, and I'll give you an example. People look at Albemarle, and people are drawn for the beautiful, and you're looking at some city people who bought the 30 acres, and it's so beautiful, and nobody told us about the redneck neighbors who said, you're from the city, aren't you? And basically didn't want us there and were there. But I thought, there's no book and there's no travel guide that's going to give me that question to ask. So my question to you is, how do you discern the questions when you're looking for a place?
Okay, now that's a really good question. And that's part of the reason why I talk about, one of the things I say in the book is, just like you would not marry somebody without first seeing them with the flu, you should not commit to a place until you have seen the underbelly. Because your reaction to the underbelly should be one of two things. You should kind of say, well, you know, you can either feel, well, isn't he cute for saying that? Isn't that charming? I'm so delighted to be next to this person who clearly doesn't want me here. Or the other reaction, you know, I was telling Brian and his wife last night that in North Carolina, you know, when we get a quarter inch of ice, it's flaming cars. I mean, we cannot handle it. And so the endearing things about North Carolina and the not so endearing things about North Carolina, our ability to not be able to drive in winter is one of them. And so you either need to think we're cute, or like we have in North Carolina, a group of folks who have moved here from other places who say, we're doing a winter defensive driving class for y'all. I mean, we got to get involved to do something about it. That's the reaction. One of those two things needs to be your reaction. But that's why I'm saying it takes a while, because every place will put their best foot forward as best they can for as long as they can. But sooner or later, just like in marriage, the honeymoon's over. And you have to know what that reality is to see if either you find it endearing or you want to at least live with it or you want to get involved to change it. Those are really the choices in that relationship. But it is something I talk about in the book and the questions you ask and all that stuff.
Okay. Well, this is just a quick reaction to this last thing. I would just hope you don't insist on monogamy. You know, I've lived in Charlottesville for 35 years, but I went to school in Boston, and I go up there all the time, and I love Cambridge, love Cambridge. And I've recently decided, okay, I will stay married to Charlottesville, but right, I'll have an affair with Cambridge every year. So that really helps. I know I would be miserable if I left my... And don't let my husband get word of this. But anyway, I'd be
this
miserable
is not totally
if I left
being recorded
Charlottesville
or anything.
And moved to Cambridge. It just wouldn't work. But,
yeah.
But she's great to have an affair with.
Well, and I think that's what vacationing does for us. And that's why vacationing is different than living somewhere. And a lot of people snowbird somewhere else or they have their little escape place. And, you know, it's not about, you know, I don't want to get too Jerry Springer, but you can take it to a certain extent where maybe one place cannot serve all your needs. And so that's why we vacation. That's why we have, if we're able to, another place that we enjoy that fits the rest of the bill for us, but wouldn't make it as our full-time partner. Just wouldn't. And that's totally acceptable.
Great last point. And I'll confess I'm having an affair with Nashville at the moment. Where my daughter's living. So we're going to wrap up here. When it comes to the aesthetic value of a place, if you want to drive attachment and place matching, as Catherine calls it, that doesn't happen without a lot of careful planning, as described in Robert's book. And we're fortunate in Charlottesville to have a lot of people very dedicated to both those things. And we hope you'll get involved with Charlottesville tomorrow. Dan Henneke's at the door there, and he'll be happy to sign you up for your emails, for our emails. So thank you for coming. Please fill out the evaluation forms, and please get your books. Thank you.
Thank y'all.